how you're spending your budget. We only have so much budget to spend on these things per year.
Right.
Let's use it in a way that's going to make a very solid platform.
Right.
So that ensures that. And it's also telling your business partners, we've done this assessment. If we have the budget, this is how we'll spend it.
First, thank you for coming and listening to the RH Podcast. We talk about business, we talk about software, we talk about technology. One last thing, if you can share this podcast with anyone you know on Facebook, on Instagram, on Snapchat, on Twitter, it really helps bring people to the podcast. We don't make any money from this. So if you can do that for us, we'd really appreciate it. You know, let's move on and listen to our next guest. Hey, Danielle, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Good morning.
Good morning to you, too. It's a bright morning for you over there.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually really gray, but it comes through.
It's really gray.
Right. Yeah.
So this is Danielle Cooper. She is a software engineering executive, to put it lightly. She's been in the industry for over 20 years, and she's led lots of different teams as a staff engineer, as an executive, and sort of just pushing software, at least to its brinks when it comes to, you know, say scaling and these sorts of issues. And we're going to talk to her today about a bunch of tech subjects in general and a bunch of leadership subjects in general. We're grateful to have her here. So welcome.
Thanks.
So I guess my first question is, what were you doing on that wagon?
Oh, on the wagon. Yeah, I was just hanging out.
That's very... yeah, what Amish community let you in?
Yeah. That was in San Diego.
Yeah?
There's a part of San Diego, I believe it's called Old Town. And they took like the original San Diego and put it out there. But loved the wagon, and I thought it was a good representation of modernization.
I thought you went to an Amish community and were there and then talking about like moving forward and then that whole, I thought that's where you were going with it. But I thought that was cool.
Totally. Yeah. I went to the Amish about how we could help them. They were not interested, as it turns out.
I think that's fair. To each their own.
Yeah, for sure.
First of all, how did you get into computing in the first place?
So that's such an interesting question. I would say, you know, short story, I started as a math major and I was like, okay, what am I? I mean, no offense to any math majors, but I started thinking about careers. And at the time, like data analytics and stuff wasn't super big or wasn't known to me. No. And so I was like, I'll just make other math majors. That will be my path. And I'm not interested in that. So I moved over to computer engineering, but it started long before that. So my mom wanted me to be a Girl Scout. And I was like, what? Why would I do that? Just when I was in elementary school, she was like, she really wanted me to be a Girl Scout. She had this dream of a daughter. And she told me later, like, she wanted to sell Girl Scout cookies. That was her real intention. But I was like, those seem like just-in-time skills that I can learn on the fly. I don't really need to, like, learn how to make brownies. And then they got to go see the robots at Chuck E. Cheese. And I was devastated. And I'm like, oh, this has always been my path. I've always been interested in, like, robotics and coding. And I've always thought it was fascinating. So it's been my path from a very early age.
So Chuck E. Cheese got you into being engineering. That's the highlight there.
Pretty much.
Okay. All right. How did you get into cloud computing specifically? How did you, that's a reasonably new space. So what made you interested in that relative to all the other things you got deeper into?
I think it was two things. I love making people happy at scale with technology, right? And then that lends itself. But even when in the early days, before we had clouds, right, we were running lots of virtual machines within VMware to do a number of different things early in my career. And it was just fascinating to me, the power of that. And then it's just a new puzzle to solve. How do I make this so fast and so efficient? And those problems are just very fun for me to think about. So that's how my first foray in, like, you know, when we first started playing around with virtual machines, just the power of it and what you could do. So at my first company, we actually, our development environment was always in a virtual machine, and that gave us the power to like do a lot of different things and spin up our dev environments very quickly. So people weren't spending hours and hours building their dev environment before they could even touch code. We were like passing around images or build scripts to just create the VM that you would be in. So all of that just got me really excited about where this could go.
We actually had someone from VMware on the podcast last, which is interesting that you're bringing it up again. So they talked a lot about solving problems at scale and for different industries and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So I do want to ask you, so what industries have you seen cloud computing really assist in your experience, in your career?
Anything that has massive amounts of users and massive amounts of data, right, really helps with that. And part of me wants to say, well, any industry could really benefit, right? But there's like a cost-benefit analysis of, right, you know, is it really worth the extra complexity when we can run everything, you know, natively on one machine, which isn't really common at this point, depending on your industry right, or where you're at, where, you know, like you're running a startup, don't have a lot of consumers yet. We need to get something out quick and dirty. Mm-hmm. Quick and dirty is not always my special skill. I'm like, oh, let's build the Cadillac and design that, or yeah, write the design for it. And then you're like, okay, now how are we going to start small and scale?
Okay. So you've had some experience in lots of different companies. One of them is realtor.com. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm asking you this is, I guess where I am, there was a huge wave with housing and purchasing. And I think that happened in North America in general. Mm-hmm. So I'm super interested in, from the inside, how you were able to deal with that. And I think that was quite the scaling challenge. I think there was a lot of scaling challenges in general during that period. But it's always interesting to see, especially in that market, how that scaling challenge was dealt with.
Yes. Yeah, so the infrastructure was set up to already take on peaks and valleys. So in those terms, we were a little set up. In other ways, we exposed flaws in the infrastructure. We created a much stronger partnership between marketing and engineering. Because what was happening was, what the heck, where are all these spikes coming from? Are we being attacked? Like, what's going on? We have this happen more than it should have, probably. But what was happening was these marketing emails were going out and they were incredibly successful. And so we weren't scaling fast enough to hit all the influx of traffic. Like over time, yeah, we could have hit the numbers, but the system wasn't set up to handle that. So we started a better partnership between marketing and engineering of, hey, when are these things coming out? Because we also wanted to keep costs down. So not having a lot of stuff just sitting there waiting, not being used. So that partnership, we had to get a little better at, create a shared calendar, send some reminders out, hey, this is about to happen, and scale up and down from there. So that's one challenge that I saw that we had to overcome. We were set up to handle the slow growth, right? But not the, right, oh my gosh, we didn't realize everyone clicks on it at the same time. So, right. I mean, we didn't realize. We didn't know that many people would be that interested. So kudos to the marketing team. Right? They were writing some really impactful good content. Copy. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Right, right. And this sort of leans more into your expertise in general, which is we have an engineering team, we have other parts of the business, and we want to build a relationship that's beneficial for both, because ultimately the goal is to bring that business forward. So if you don't mind, could you talk a little bit about how you were able to, I think, with very disparate mentalities, engineering and marketing, build that relationship? Because I think very much these are very opposite kinds of people.
Yeah. And we had talked about this a little bit before, right? Of building the business case for what you need in engineering. So if you have, you know, and I've been in companies where the entire chain is pretty technical, all the way up to C-suite. And so when you say, oh, well, we need to automate this or that, everyone just automatically understands why that's going to allow us to generate more revenue, be more efficient, get stuff out to market faster. But if you're a non-technical, very business-oriented person, if it ain't broke, why fix it?
Right.
and okay, well, what's our definition of broken? But building that business case for why we need time to conquer, let's say, tech debt or automation, like saying, hey, we could decrease our time to market by 30% if we can get this automation of our deployment in place. And it's been interesting to me as I move from company to company. To me, it's table stakes to have an automated deployment. But I've
talked to what do you mean by table stakes?
Like it's 101, we automate our deployments so that they are safe and that they, you know, happen very quickly and they're not reliant on me not being tired that day and not fat fingering a number, which is something else that's happened. Number of clusters was way too low because somebody, and like, why are we allowing that to be manually input with every build? That's a whole nother thing.
Right.
So like being able to talk about these use cases to the business. And unfortunately, sometimes for those, hey, we're about to run into this scenario. Until you run into it, there's just not going to be a lot of listening. But what you can do is use the mistakes from industry to say, hey, look what happened over here. We're actually at risk of that too. That helps get some fire under it. But also saying, this is how much money we can save. This is how much quicker we can get to market. Like put it in terms of how am I going to benefit you as a business person with this tech change that I really want to make is important.
Right.
So that, you know, whether it's marketing or finance or whoever needs to sign off and product especially.
Right.
Really, how do I tie those things? And then another thing is measuring and keeping those promises. So I've also seen where engineering makes those sorts of promises. We're going to get this 30% in decrease in time to market, or we're going to save this much money. Either we don't measure it and we don't report it back, or it takes too long, or we never quite get there and products can really feel it. And then they're not going to trust the next time you say. Even if you have data, they're like, well, yeah, you said that last time. So really delivering on those promises and measuring and showing that it happened is an important part of that relationship building.
Right. So from what I got from that measuring, obviously communication, business case building, and all those things, essentially, they build trust for, I guess, that department, or I guess that purpose that you're sort of pushing forward for. I saw something that you put up talking about, I think it was related to tech debt, and there was something needed to be done, and there was an issue. Things were down. It wasn't upgraded, and the version of the module was so old, and it was from one language to another, and Google didn't have that version. It was Python 2. I'm trying not to be too technical, but it was Python 2. They didn't support that, so you had to go to them and tell them to help you support that before, so that that module can actually work and things of that nature. And then you were able to do it maybe 8 hours later. But if you guys had at that time had it a bit more modern, even a little bit, then that wouldn't have happened and all that. So I'm sure for a lot of companies, there are a lot of different software pieces that are maintained or are not maintained. Based, you know, or at least maybe are focused on or not focused on, right? Because if it that broke, don't fix it mentality, it happens everywhere. So how do you sort of keep ahead on all these different projects, make sure all the changes within their own technical ecosystems are there? And for companies specifically, they're not really into tech and like have someone that's always, you know, bringing that technology forward. How do you, or how do you get set up your organization to track all that stuff?
Yeah, so I would say at least once a year, you know, we're doing an assessment. Like,
that's not too bad, actually.
Yeah, I mean, because like you're not, you will catch that big of an issue at least once a year of like, what are technologies? What are they running on? Has that been end of life? There's so many like things that are just kind of simple. So at Realtor, we did an assessment across our platforms to talk about all of those things and also create a map between what teams own what, where things are located that just didn't exist before. It was all tribal knowledge. And so if you have that mapping, then you can highlight the areas of biggest risk. And that's something I learned from actually my time working at Northrop Grumman is doing risk assessment. And really deep diving into that. And then there's several factors that go into it. You can give it a score, And then you focus on the things, you know, pick your top 10, your top five, whatever you have budget for, to say, no, these are going to get cleaned up in the next 6 months or however long you need. And one of those factors is criticality to the overall business. Is this on the critical revenue generating path, right? If it is, those things inherently carry more risk. We need to, they are our babies. We need to really be on top of those and spend more of our budget dollars on that. There's always like other ways we're making revenue, but they're not like 50 or 60% of our revenue is
cash flow
spread across like 10%, 5%. You know, those things carry less risk inherently. So that's one way to really create and prioritize that list and make sure that you're laser focused on how you're spending your budget. We only have so much budget to spend on these things per year. Like, let's use it in a way that's really going to make a very solid platform, right? The easiest way to generate revenue is to keep your platform up and running. That ensures that. And it's also telling your business partners, we've done this assessment. If we have the budget, this is how we'll spend it. I've seen too many times where, we want 20% protect debt. Sometimes that works. But what I've seen with some product managers.
What do you mean by we want 20%? We want it to be only 20%?
Oh, 20% of our like sprint budget on either shoring up the system or tech debt.
It would be tech debt. Got it. Right.
And And sometimes some product managers are totally on board with that for a number of different reasons.
Okay.
Some are not. They're like, well, I need to see where that's going. And having that crisp list of these are the items and this is why they're at risk for the business can really help get you that budget.
Okay. What have you seen are the reasons why product managers feel a little bit uncomfortable with tech debt, right? Like sometimes it feels more emotional than it is because it's, I understand that it's not business. It doesn't bring in business directly, but it is understandable that there's something needs to be maintained to some degree. So where is that mismatch? And especially with people with a lot of experience, if you see a very experienced person that doesn't really believe in tech debt, what's going on there?
Yes.
That you can probably, you know, a bit of a psychologist's jobs now, but.
Right. And you know, it's the danger of generalizing people. So, but.
Right.
One of the things that I've definitely seen, whether we're talking about tech debt or anything else, is we have typically two functions who have different goals, right? So product is to a lot of times drive additional streams of revenue, right? And that's new features. What are we adding? How are we increasing the revenue coming in from what's already there? Then we have engineering, who is like, keep your systems up, uptime, door metrics, all of these things you should be pursuing. And so those things, and sometimes like engineering I've seen don't even have those goals. They still have the product goals, but inherently we know, well, we're not going to generate revenue if the site's not up. So there's like this mishmash of product is getting a lot of pressure to do different things. And we're not always communicating. I saw this very clearly in several different companies where we are not letting product know, oh yeah, did you know the system went down overnight and that we spent 8 hours getting it back up? And this is the revenue, the estimated revenue loss from that time. So, you know, it was just like, because it was those things are such a fire within engineering. None of the product people were on our channels. They're not seeing that happening. So like they had
really,
I mean, I can remember a couple of very large tech incidents and product had no idea that happened. And then it was interesting because we go into our monthly analytics meeting and there's like this dip. Well, what happened? And we're like, we had that major tech incident. Wait, what? Having more communication, right, is just key to everything. And then also, I think the successful organizations also put some of those quality metrics on the product managers as well, right? Saying we need to maintain, you know, in D, increase our quality metrics, right?
What do you mean by quality metrics? Like in terms of deck debt?
So like DORA or uptime or all those things. And it's okay, interesting because if you think about like consumer satisfaction ratings, right? A lot of, if you read, a lot of it comes from reviews and all that. But a lot of that is this feature dynamic. That's part of it. And that's the part engineering can control because there's some of it where it's like, I don't like the way this feature works. Well, okay. We had some input as engineers, but a lot of times that was done with research from other teams and we were just executing it. But that like, hey, does it function the way it's supposed to? Or was it even there when I went to use it? Or was the site down, right? That's something that we can all agree on, but isn't as obvious when you're talking about consumer satisfaction. So asking product managers, like allowing them to have insight into all of our quality metrics and also putting the onus on them that their teams need to maintain those in addition to driving new revenue streams, I think can be really helpful with that.
What kind of organization gets to the point where their product team doesn't understand that something did or a product did or didn't work in production at a particular time? Because then that kind of lapse in communication that would still have a functioning business, there's some sectors they wouldn't be able to like absorb that, right? And then some sectors that it would be fine. So, or even some kind of, you know, or maybe some businesses, I'm not sure, right? But what is that? Like what kind of situation can happen in that? Like, so just to me, I have a more concrete question, like the power grid can't have that.
Right.
Like if the power, right? Power
grid, all
if the power's out,
yeah,
we'll all know. There's no way it's like that there was no power on Tuesday. What do you mean? So that's sort of how I'm just making sure I'm framing that question properly.
Yeah, I totally get it. So when you are if you think about a website like realtor.com, right? There's a lot of different verticals within there. And if you have appropriately kind of microserviced yourself out, you're not, for a lot of tech incidents, the hope is that your blast radius is small. So if one vertical has an issue, the other ones aren't as impacted. So then also a lot of things can happen underneath the hood that, you know, you just don't become aware of. I think, and as we're talking, another thing I think can happen, as much as I'm like, communication, transparency, over communication, sometimes there's like so much coming at you, you just start to shut down. So you're like, I muted that channel because I just have too many channels, right?
Right.
So like appropriate and like having those, one of the things that I've set up in the past at multiple organizations is like a wiki page that say, hey, these are the channels that you really need to pay attention to. Here's some that are for fun. Here's some if you're just really interested in what's going on in the business or engineering would be useful. So helping people self-serve, but giving a little bit better guidance. It's very interesting to me when you're talking to someone and they're like, how did you know that? And I'm like, well, aren't you on XYZ channel? Like, it's all there. And they're like, I didn't even know that existed, right? So while I love Slack and other tools, right? If you don't know the channel exists, like, it's not going to tell you. So how do we do that better? So having sort of a mapping of that or like a Q&A bot thing that has like the answer, like, and if you'd like to know more, join this Slack channel, right? Kind of like an index of your information.
Oh, so there's a feature in Slack with that where?
No, I am like third party tools to do that. And there's a couple of those. I don't want to like, you know, I'm not on here to do one product or the other, but I have my loves.
That's fair.
Yeah. But like that, I really, and I could go on about that, about communication and like these, a Q&A index into your large ways that people document, right? We have people doing it in GitLab or Confluence or like Google Docs. It's all over the place. Right. Airtable.
Notion.
But if you have,
right.
If you have one index where you can just go in, ask a question, and then it points to the right thing, that helps with that as well and allows people to self-service
that information.
But long story short, that's how you get to that point, right? Where you have multiple revenue streams, some of the things aren't obvious that it's down, right? Oh, it all looks like it worked, but that data didn't go anywhere. And no one knows that in engineering. So those sorts of things, I think, are how it can happen.
It's interesting where, you know, you almost, gave in some ways two examples of microservice architecture, one in the system that prevents it from leaking throughout the organization relative to different verticals. And then on the other side, when communication microservice architecture doesn't work because people don't have access to these local maximums in a way. So it's interesting, maybe for myself, to draw this sort of parallel between those two different things. So to go then sort of hampering down back on the communication piece, how do you communicate all these concerns to your engineering team? Because a lot of these things we talked about are how engineering affects business, but then how do you do it in the reverse where you figure out how to explain to business how it engineering affects the other way around? Basically, how do you explain to engineers how business affects them?
Yes. And, you know, I will say it can be very challenging. And it's so funny. All engineers, myself included, when I started getting this feedback, have the almost identical response. There's never a, oh, yeah, that makes sense, usually. There's a, like, there's this contraction in us. It's like, well, that's dumb. They should just know. And I will say, it's very funny. When I first started getting this feedback, I was thinking about it. And I'm like, yeah, that was my first react because I was so used to having a technical chain all the way up above me. Right. So I never had to like tie those things together for them. And this feedback came when that I was the highest ranking technical person in the chain.
Right.
And so beyond me, I had to start speaking differently.
Right.
And when I, you know, first started, it was just like, where did I land? What happened?
Right.
And then you get out and you start, you know, branching out and you're like, oh, that's not uncommon. The entire technical or the entire chain being technical is actually uncommon.
Right.
So yeah, like just continue, you know, you make the first statement, you watch the contraction happen and you watch the frustration happen. And then, you know, you just, okay, let's start again. So let's pretend like you don't know X, Y, Z, and you only know about dollars, cents, or time. How would you explain it in that way? And how would you like make those connections for people? And so, yeah, like I like to talk about knitting sweaters for some reason. Like I don't knit, but I think it's a great, it's like, okay, engineering team, we're over here knitting a sweater. You told us to knit the sweater. We're knitting the sweater. And they're like, okay, but we need to switch priorities quickly and move over and go here. And we're like, okay, so you know I can't take this sweater that I was knitting and start, and we're starting with a new sweater over here. They don't match. So like, I can't add this knit to that knit. And now I'm like, my time is split and we've lost our momentum in that. So that's one of the ways that I'm like, try to explain to people, if you started me down this path, it's not like I'm starting from here. I have to start from zero and start again. And then if you ask me to pop back over here, I've got to remember what that pattern is. And that's going to take some time. So like, that's one of the examples that I use to how try to explain to business people why we can't just magically switch and things are super fast. Because I see that a lot. Well, I don't understand. Yeah, like you were already doing this, just do this. And I'm like, those are two different sweaters. I know it looks like the same sweater. And every now and then it is. Oh yeah, there's some building blocks here we can use. But a lot of times it's like, I know it feels that way, but it's just not for one reason or another.
Got it. So there's different departments, marketing, product, finance, sales. And obviously, depending on the size of the company, there's more like departments that are kind of more specialized or a combination of two different like ideas. Do you see like a difference between how you communicate to each one? Like there's marketing and sales are probably kind of similar. Product is more related to engineering and more directly associated. But like a department like procurement would be kind of like a different thing. And so is there like for each department a way that they like to be communicated to, or is there sort of almost like a gradation, or do you have sort of philosophy on each one and how to like engage with them and let them know that, you know, we're building different sweaters here, as you would say?
Yeah. So I think it's where EQ comes into play. So individuals are really important, and you can make generalizations about individuals within different departments to a degree.
Right.
But I have seen too many times where it's like, oh, they're in this department. I know what motivates them, or I know what they care about. And you're wrong. For whatever reason, that person doesn't fit the mold. So not necessarily trying to generalize everyone and understand, okay, what are their pain points, this particular person's pain points or fears. Now, if you're trying to convince a body of people, what is goals are they, do they have? What pressures do they have? Because a lot of times what I see is people won't come out and say what their underlying concern is. It'll be a lot of these things that feel disparate. And you can just kind of sense there's something they're not saying, because I just addressed all of these. And if you can ask questions and get to that root, what is the main concern here? Then, and a lot of times I've seen it, or even in myself, we didn't address it because it was a no-brainer to us. We already understood how the technology took care of that fear, so we didn't bring it up. And it was like, oh, that's what you, this is why I haven't spoken about that, because XYZ has happened, and like, we know that that's not an issue. And then, you know, you can bring the stress level down and move on with the conversation. So I would say you can come in with a little bit of preconceived notion, but really seeing each person as an individual, and everyone has their own stressors, and how can you speak to them can be very helpful.
Right. So I guess hopefully this is a more fun question for you. What is the most challenging kind of individual you have encountered when trying to get things done? That way you don't have to say a name.
That's a great question. I'm trying to like boil it down to one archetype or factor.
Stuff. Yeah.
I would almost say someone who doesn't actually understand how to be successful in their role quite yet.
Oh, that's sad.
And so they don't know what they need. And so you're trying to help them, but you're not in their role. Like, you're not in their function. So as much as you can try to help them, it's like sometimes it can be really hard because you're getting different direction from day to day. And you're like, but yesterday you said this and today you said that. And it's fine. Like, I'll give you all the information, but I'm not seeing like the overall picture and how this ties in. And I can't help you. So that can be challenging for sure.
How do you deal with that? I didn't expect that answer. So how do you make that work for you? Or can you even, right? Because that's, you're doing two jobs now, realistically.
Yeah. So I think it depends. Sometimes quick wins can help. Like, oh, okay, well, I can give you XYZ quick win, which means I built trust. Now you can start trusting me a little bit more. And like, how do I build trust with this individual over time? That can be helpful. And it depends. Sometimes it's out of your control and it depends on their own growth. I can tell you one situation where it was nice that I could pinpoint like, oh, okay. So we had come up with over like the course of 6 months, come up with an SDLC and who between product, project, and engineering owned each piece, right? And who's going to be responsible for guiding which part. And it was working really, really well. We were pulling stuff to the left. We were executing more. We were getting stuff out on time or early. And we had this new person come in. And they were fighting us so much on it. Like, well, I want to own this and this and this.
Fighting you on ownership or?
Yeah, on ownership. Okay. Like, this is my responsibility and this and this. And we were like, okay, let's start from zero and explain how we got here and trying to like guide him along. And eventually I realized, oh, wait, this person is trying to take ownership. And that was a problem that we had seen in their function of like, a lot of people in that function do not take this much ownership. And I just was like, hey, I'm going to take a minute to say, I so appreciate the level of ownership you want to take in this process. That's awesome. You want us to be successful and, you know, you want to own that any part that you can to make that happen. That's awesome. Right. I so appreciate that. If you try to take that level of ownership at this particular company, you will probably fail because it's too much for any one person. That's why we have all of these people. This is not the only project that you're managing. Like, you have three others. If you try to do this, so you need to rely on us, and we're responsible to you for these outcomes. And it just completely changed the tenor of the conversation. The person came back to me later with other conflicts he was having within the business. Hey, how would you handle this? So like, right. And it was simply because I appreciated what he was trying to do and his fear. If I don't have the ownership, it's going to fail. And my promise to him, I get it. I want it to be successful too. And I'm responsible to you to make that happen. That was one situation where I was able to like, oh, this is the fear and this is right. How I can address it. And some people will let you do that. Other people still hold on, but it's kind of like identifying in the individuals what you can do. And appreciation goes so, so far. That right. helps a lot because we all want to be appreciated and we all want right. to be seen. And that, you know, like, okay, I see you, I feel you, this is how I can help, can go a really long way. And sometimes, you know, like I have had people say that to me and I'm like, yeah, that's not helpful, right? So there's always, you know, we can't help everyone, but we can try and right. we can offer our support. How can I help? And people won't right. always have an answer for that, but a lot of times they will. Or you can offer like one or two small things and then just the relationship building is so important.
So I'm going to pivot into sort of this idea of ownership that you talked about, mm-hmm. where this happened in a very positive way with this person coming in, but it was interpreted not necessarily the best way initially, right? So when we talk about ownership with regards to the internal team, we flip back. We talked about the most difficult kind of person to sort of engage with, but what kinds of person inside the engineering team, right, is first of all, difficult to engage with? Best to engage with, you know, what kind of people do you have in sort of the landscape of engineers and how do you sort of deal with them?
Yeah, this feels a little like controversial, right?
Go for it.
But very transparently, I feel like the hardest type of individual to deal with is the individual that has what feels like an innate, but it's not, I don't think it's innate, need to be the smartest person in the room.
Well, because
they can't be wrong, right? Like, yeah. And so you can't have a meaningful and productive conversation without different tricks and techniques. So one of the ways that I help with that is to, for like design decisions, right? Those can be really emotional. And a lot of it comes down to if you reject my
software design, right?
Yeah, software design.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, architecture.
Architecture. Like
we should
got
do
it.
This
got
or it. That. Because we all want to be smart. That's just a need.
Right.
And to reject our idea oftentimes is to reject me, right? Like that's really what's happening underneath the hood there a lot of times. So the way that I try to pull that out is okay, here are the 10 factors that we need to consider for each step. Each decision we need to make in this architecture and how it supports the business. Because a lot of times it's the answer to an architecture question is it depends. It's like, well, from a business standpoint, we actually have certain things we need to meet and this decision directly impacts that. So if you can pull out before you even start, these are the factors that each of our decisions and design points, like points in the design need to be and like how they're weighted. You can bring it back when there's like this conflict of, oh, we should go this way or that way. Okay, well, how do they score when we come to the 10 factors? You can, so it takes it out of you versus me and onto this third party that it doesn't have, I don't want to say it, it's like less subjective.
Oh, yeah, okay. It's a bit when more worthless. So yeah. So it makes it less stressful to, it makes less, there's a lot less of a human factor. So yeah. So all the sort of human emotions get out of it and then an objective decision can be made.
Yes.
Right.
So that's one way to help with that. I need to be the smartest person in the room. Okay. The smartest person in the room, we're all that, and we're all tying what we want to do to the business outcomes that we want to achieve. Or business can be even like, oh, it needs to support our current org structure. That's not an option. Like, we need to have these dependencies within engineering in addition to how it drives business outcomes like revenue and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So like there's a lot of different ways that you can structure those factors depending on the needs of your entire organization. But like being able to bring that back to that very like concrete and then, oh, okay, yeah, I really like the solution, but it's not going to move the needle. So I can let it go and we can move on. So that's got hardest. And then you had talked about the, you know, what's the best, right?
What's your favorite?
I mean, my favorite are people who are open, like, to discussing new ideas and new opportunities and, like, always learning and always taking responsibility for things. Like, oh, that's not my job. Like, that's not my favorite, right? Like, I, like, okay, I'll take care of it or, you know, and that actually has been something as I have moved up the chain. I am a, oh, I'll take care of it person. And eventually it's like, oh, no, my job is to coach others to take care of it.
Right.
Which can feel like, what do I do all day? Like, I like to do these things, right?
Yeah.
But that's not the job anymore, and people aren't growing if you're doing that. But I love the sorts of people who you give them a problem. And like, I had a manager one time, and he was just like, I would give him kind of the direction and what I was thinking and what problem needed to be solved. And he would come back with 10 things I didn't even think about. That were like, yeah, that's a good point. Have an incredible, I could give him anything. And he thought through it more than me. And I appreciated that because I see sometimes that people are afraid, like, oh, well, this isn't what she said, so I'm afraid to do it. I see that crop up a little bit sometimes. And I get it, right? Like, I've had to be more careful as my title has increased of trying to not stifle creativity. The people who are like, oh no, yeah, like I can do this even better than what she said. That's great.
Right.
Not even as a competition thing. I'm just trying to do the right thing. Love those people.
Yeah. And honestly, doing it better than you've been asked to do is always, is something, I think it's a great thing if you have someone who can do that with you. Those kinds of people are amazing and deserve as much support as they can get, you know? So
yeah,
I'm 100%. All for that.
And no one person has all the answers.
Right.
And I love people like Dematic. We kept a lot of very detailed records, I'll call it, but Jira tickets and whatever. And we noticed there was one engineer and his stuff would just pass QA with flying colors, like every time. And so we would go out and he was fresh out of school. And we're like, so what you doing over there? Because you have this impeccable track record for quality. And he was like, well, I go talk to the QA team and to the project manager about how it's going to be used before I start coding. And we're like, is everyone not doing that? Like, it was just really, like, he was very thorough. He's like, yeah, I don't want to reinvent the wheel because I didn't understand something. I figure out how my feature fits into the larger system. And then I could, like, design and code from there. And it was just, I was like, I love that. Like, he was just a big picture thinker. And it really, it showed in his work.
So what's your favorite part about dealing with all these challenges? Right. There's so many things coming from so many different directions and so many ways each thing needs to be presented relative to the person and so much preparation needed if anything interesting is going to happen. And so there's, you know, several people or people have different ways of sort of feeling about that. Some people might feel overwhelmed that they have to do so much before they do something that they would want to do. Some people really don't like emotional labor. They don't like having to consider this other person's whole ecosystem as an individual and then sort of massage towards a goal. And you're sort of doing it at scale for different kinds of people. And even when I asked you, hey, for each department, what kind of person? You said, no, I actually go at the individual level. So that just multiplies the mental models that you have to keep in order to get things moving forward. So what do you like about all this?
I love bringing calm to chaos. Completely transparently, I have seen people feel so disconnected, you know, just as our world has become computers and whatever, all these factors. And people feel unseen, unheard, and disconnected. And so I love building tech that absolutely catapults growth. So fun to me. I love creating systems that are incredibly efficient, right? I make one little tweak and all of these people are impacted. And we're like generating all of this revenue because of just one, like a few lines of code. That's so fun to me. But I also love being able to talk about, do the human side underneath it, like in the people that are creating that tech to feel heard and connected and like maybe even bring some inner healing to people. And part of that is my own journey of I have learned so much and I love passing that on to people. And I feel like it's just made me a better person in general, not a better person, like, but a more calm, I have more space for people. And I want to help people have that more feeling of the world is a friendly place and I have an important part in it. Like that just excites me and like teaching people how to have those connections and create them in their own life by leading by example. That's one of the reasons that I think I have space for that. And that's something that I had to develop over time for sure. Like definitely coaching has been incredibly helpful. Like I have a coach and the way that she like presents and information is I've never heard like before. And I'm like, I didn't know that was available in this lifetime. And so as I've grown, I just want to share it. And I want everyone to be as happy as me. So that's one of the reasons that I have calories for that, if you will.
Well, if people want to connect with you, where can they find you?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn. It is, you know, the LinkedIn, whatever, Danielle-N-Cooper. I don't have a website or anything, yeah, it's the best place.
Well, thank you so much for, you know, reaching out to us and talking to us and allowing us to learn from you. And, I think it was a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It was so fun. I loved your questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Take care.